Bonsoir. Bonsoir, bienvenue. Je suis Martin Grant, le doyen de la faculté des sciences. Maintenant, nous avons le spectacle Lorne Trottier, the Public Science Symposium. This is the 10th year of the support for the Trottier Family Foundation for the Public Science Foundation. And I'd like to recognize that we've reached a decade right now. Quite amazing. It started in, that was an applause line. It started in the summer of 2005, and I had lunch with Lorne, and he said, Martin, people in the outside world would like to hear about science, and they'd like to hear about real scientists and what real science is about. And I said, yeah, I'd kind of like to hear that myself. And he said, for example, climate change, or the anthropic principle, or how the brain works, or what can be done about the planet in terms of geoengineering. And for 10 years, we have systematically gone through the hottest topics in science. It has come to the point where it not only is a symposium about science and outreach of science, but has had, since the beginning, elements of public science policy. The very first symposium, which was on climate change, for example, and this joke was I've made many years, and Joe Schwartz has told me that jokes never get old, but this one is getting surprisingly old. Why that's funny, I don't know, but and the two of the people who attended our very first Lorne Trottier Public Science Symposium the first year were future prime ministers of Canada, Thomas Mulcair and Justin Trudeau. And 5 years ago, that was a lot funnier than it is now. One of our long-term supporters of the symposium has been our university's provost, Tony Massey. And Tony has come to our symposiums for the last 10 years, either very publicly, as he is today, and he'll give a presentation in a minute, or just sitting and listening to the symposium because he's interested in what's happening and what is topical and important in science today. Tony has been a provost at McGill for since 2005. He's a sociologist with interest in science and a minor degree in mathematics, and we appreciate his support over the years for the Public Science Policy Symposium and all the help you provided, Tony, in the Faculty of Science. With that, I would like to invite Tony to say a few words.
Thank you, Martin. Monsieur Trottier, Madame Roussel, Mesdames et Messieurs, je vous souhaite la bienvenue à 2014 Symposium Scientifique pour le public Lorne Trottier and the provocative title, Are We Alone? Searching for Life Out There. Let me first of all thank the Faculty of Science and the organizers of the symposium for once again giving me the honor and the privilege of providing the official university welcome on behalf of the principal, Suzanne Fortier, who unfortunately couldn't be here this evening. And I also have the opportunity to give a few remarks of my own about the topic leading into the panel discussion. McGill has a really long history of reaching out and giving the public something for the money that's invested in it by them. It also benefits enormously from the generosity of donors like the Trottiers in what they've done for McGill. This series is made possible because Monsieur Trottier and his family foundation have been one of the university's largest supporters, but also one of its most esteemed graduates. Let me just share with you a few things about Monsieur Trottier. Lorne graduated with two degrees from McGill, a B.Eng. in 1970 and a Master's in Engineering in 1973. And in 2006, he was awarded an honorary doctorate. He's also a governor emeritus of McGill University. These are just a few of the things that the Family Foundation and Lorne himself have been doing for McGill. There is the Lorne Trottier Information Technology Building, created to be the new home for the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the School of Computer Science. the Trottier Chair in Astrophysics and Cosmology in the Faculty of Science, the Trottier Chair in Aerospace Engineering in the Faculty of Engineering, and the Trottier Engineering Graduate Fellowships for incoming PhD students. There's also the Trottier Institute for Science and Public Policy in the Faculty of Science, and the Trottier Institute for Sustainability in Engineering and Design in the Faculty of Engineering. Among the many contributions, these endowments, the endowment for this special symposium series has been one that has truly captured public attention here in Montreal, not just for McGill, but for what we do for science outreach in our city, and it also has provided, through the World Wide Web, an important outreach to the rest of the global community about what science means and why we do it the way we do it at McGill. Since 2005, this symposium has truly led us on a provocative adventure in looking at many important and different questions. Every year, the Trottier Public Science Symposium challenges McGill, Montreal, and the global community with a stimulating and provocative question or theme. This is always done from the point of view of science, which demands evidence be grounded in our senses and our reason. The frame of reference for these talks and panels is just as much about process as it is about conclusions. It's about how we know what we know as much as what we actually know. This year is no exception. The very nature of the question will push us to think long, hard, and deep about how we could possibly know if we are indeed alone in the universe. Science advances by testing hypotheses that are drawn from theories that reflect certain points of view. When I asked myself, how would I think about the hypotheses that could be out there in terms of how we answer the question, are we alone, I identified for myself two opposing perspectives. One approach could simply be, life is an anomaly. It happened here in an unpredictable, unrepeatable way, very eventful for us to be here, but it just happened on Earth and it really wouldn't happen anywhere else. Another hypothesis or frame of reference would be life is inevitable in the universe. We know the laws of physics, chemistry, and biology, and we know what to look for, and we think it is, in fact, repeatable, and it's out there, and we just have to find it. There's a second layer to that. If we could recognize life out there, would we also be able to find intelligent life out there? And so there are many questions about are we alone in the universe that need to be answered by looking at science here on Earth, looking at life in extremes, looking for the things on other planets in our solar system that might be evidence of life. And we also have to think about the things that would tell us that there is intelligent life and that we should and may soon hear a message about that. This would be an important part of the way in which science advances and that these symposiums help us to think about those questions. Are we alone? Is life inevitable? Is life an accident? We're going to turn to a series of experts who are going to answer those questions for us. On behalf of McGill University, I just wanted to again take the opportunity to thank all of you for coming and participating, whether you're here in the room or out in the internet, and also thank the Trottiers formally and officially for their participation in this. I'm now going to turn the podium over to Dr. Joe Schwartz, who will introduce the speakers for this evening and for the rest of the symposium. Thank you.
Thank you, Provost Massey. One day, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson were out on a camping trip. And in the middle of the night, Holmes turns to Watson and pokes him in the side and says, "Watson, look up there. What do you think?" And Dr. Watson looks up and he says, "Look at all the millions of stars and God knows how many civilizations out there, the vastness of the universe, and we're just so insignificant. And you, Holmes, what do you think?" And he replied, "Oh, Watson, you're wrong as always. You find the trifles and don't see the important thing. Someone stole our tent." Believe it or not, couple of years ago, that joke won a contest in Britain as the best joke ever by a magazine that was running such a competition. Well, the reason that I think it's relevant to start with that particular joke is because Watson did not look for a trifle. In fact, he saw the essence, because the size of the universe is unbelievable, and we are on this insignificant little planet in an insignificant little galaxy. And of course, we wonder about how we are here and whether or not we can get away from here. I mean, most of us grew up reading books. I certainly did. One of the first books I ever read was From the Earth to the Moon by Jules Verne. I remember thinking about, you know, is this possible? And then I came to Canada in 1956. One of the first TV shows I ever saw was Rocky Jones, Space Ranger. And some of you may remember that, although you'll be giving away your age if you know that. But what was really interesting about that was that the Space Ranger went out to you know, solve crime in the universe. And he would take off and land with a rocket going straight up and land also at the same place from where he started. And this is something that is being explored now and is actually possible. It is going to happen. And then there were things like Lost in Space, which was, you know, kind of imaginative. And then, of course, the best one of all was Star Trek. And most of us enjoyed that at some time. And the movies, of course, kept coming, Gravity, which was interesting, even though they didn't get the science quite right. But the fact is that we humans have gotten the science right, because we have been up there, at least some of us have, and have traveled in space and have seen the Earth and report that it really is round just the way that we thought. We've been to the moon, taken that one small step, and indeed it is a very small step, 1.2 light seconds away from Earth. The next logical one is Mars, which, depending on the time of its orbit, anywhere from 4 to 20 light minutes away. And then, of course, everything else is so much further. We're talking about light years. But looking up at that red planet, historically, of course, we wondered what was there. And we had all kinds of visions of Martians and what might they look like. And, of course, that kind of pushed the imagination. But interestingly enough, back in 1938, when H.G. Wells on radio told the story of the War of the Worlds, or at least Orson Welles told the story of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, people actually believed it, and they thought that an invasion was underway. The New York Times had it on the front page. So it's no question that there was and still is widespread belief of visitations by aliens, as you can see reported. In fact, in New Jersey, there's actually a plaque at the place where the Martians supposedly landed in 1938. It was so widely believed. Well, they never did that, but we have done the opposite. We have gone to the red planet and landed there and explored it. And you will hear about that in just a couple of minutes. But of course, human imagination doesn't stop with that. There was no landing site for flying saucers found on Mars or any place where they would have taken off from. But that hasn't stopped people from thinking that we are being visited by flying saucers. And it is interesting that, you know, we see all kinds of reports of these things being viewed, and we even see pictures. But interestingly enough, all these pictures are taken by a camera made in the 1930s and held by someone with Parkinson's disease. We never see any good quality pictures. And then, of course, we have other silliness out there, too, about astrology and how our future is in the stars and what the constellations can tell us. Well, in science, we know what they can tell us, because it's basically a lot of quackery. And as Isaac Asimov said it very well, we don't have to look for foolishness, because there is indeed so much beauty in science itself. Real science is fantastic. And it's the real science, of course, that we are going to explore over the next two evenings here. We're going to explore, indeed, the search for life out there using real scientific equipment, radio telescopes, and you will hear about that a little bit later today. And you'll also recognize, I think, our speaker because she was the model for Jodie Foster in the movie Contact, which was a very, very popular movie. And tomorrow night we'll hear other interesting things. We'll hear about exoplanets, and we'll also hear about myths and facts in terms of space travel. But to get the evening going here, I would like to call on our own astrophysicist here at McGill, Professor Vicky Caspi, who holds the Lorne Trottier Chair in Astrophysics, to introduce our speakers. And she is very well adept at doing this because she has introduced some very famous people. When William Shatner was here to get an honorary degree, Vicky had the chance of honoring him. And now she has the chance of honoring our next two speakers, and we'll call on Vicky for the introduction.
Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speakers. Dr. Jim Bell. Jim Bell is a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona, an adjunct professor in the Department of Astronomy at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and a distinguished visiting scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Jim is an active planetary scientist and has been heavily involved in many NASA robotic space exploration missions, and is the lead scientist in charge of the panoramic camera, PanCam, a stereoscopic imaging system on the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, and is the deputy PI of the MassCam camera system on the Curiosity rover. Jim is also extremely active and prolific public communicator of science and space exploration and is president of the Planetary Society. He's a frequent contributor to popular astronomy and science magazines like Sky and Telescope, Astronomy, and Scientific American, and to radio shows and internet blogs about astronomy and space. He has appeared on a variety of television shows, including NBC's Today Show, CNN's This American Morning, on PBS's NewsHour, and on the Discovery, National Geographic, Wall Street Journal, and History Channels. Now, Dr. Jill Tarter. Jill Tarter holds the Bernard M. Oliver Chair for SETI Research at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, and serves as a member of the Board of Trustees for that institution. Tarter received her Bachelor of Engineering Physics degree with distinction from Cornell University and her Master's degree and a PhD in Astronomy from the University of California at Berkeley. She has spent the majority of her professional career attempting to answer the old human question, are we alone, by searching for evidence of technological civilizations beyond Earth. She served as project scientist for NASA's SETI program, the High Resolution Microwave Survey, and has conducted numerous observational programs at radio observatories worldwide. She is a fellow of the American Academy for Advancement of Sciences, the California Academy of Sciences, and the Explorers Club, and was named one of Time's 100 most influential people in the world in 2004 and one of the Time 25 in space in 2012. She received a TED Prize in 2009 and many public service awards from NASA, as well as multiple awards for communicating science to the public. Since 1993, she has served in a leadership role to design and build the Allen Telescope Array and to secure private funding and to continue the exploratory science of SETI. Many people are, of course, familiar with her work that Dr. Joe mentioned as portrayed by Jodie Foster in the major motion picture Contact. And just as a personal note, she might not realize this, but as a radio astronomer, she was a tremendous role model to me when I was becoming an astronomer. And so without further ado, I introduce to you Dr. Jim Bell and Dr. Jill Tarter.
Bonsoir. It's great to be here, Montreal. Thank you, Vicky, for that introduction. Thank you, Dr. Joe, for the great hospitality and the folks here at McGill. Thank you, Lorne Trottier and family, for the amazing things you do for this community, this university, and for the world through organizations like Planetary Society. Hey, let's go to Mars. What do you think? Let's do it. Okay. My particular spin on the "Are We Alone?" question comes through the work that I am very, very lucky to do with hundreds and hundreds of other colleagues in NASA's exploration of Mars. That's a very active program, and I'll go through what some of the rovers have been doing to get at that issue of the possibility of life on Mars. It's sort of, you know, one of the nearest places that we can go off our planet to look for that evidence. So I'll talk a little bit about the science behind what we're doing. I'll talk a little bit about the technology and the robotics and other ways that we try to do that science. Very quickly throw some results at you, and some of them are tentative, and some of them are hotly debated and argued. I debated whether to throw a couple of movies in, and I said, yeah, they probably like movies. Let's put a couple of movies in just to remind us of how amazing some of this technology is that allows us to do this kind of science. So that's what I'm hoping to do. And the story really starts, I wonder if we could maybe get the lights down a little bit more, that'd be cool. The story really starts with this enigmatic planet, the next one out from Earth, planet Mars. Of course, we've observed it telescopically for centuries, and now we've observed it up close with space missions for decades. And it's an Earth-like place in many respects, has a thin atmosphere, has wind and weather on its surface, has giant volcanoes that we think are not active, but it's certainly a process that we're familiar with on the Earth today. And the enigma is that while the planet today is very cold and very dry and very inhospitable in many different ways to life as we know it, at least on the surface, there's all this evidence from this armada of orbiters and now landers and rovers that the world has sent to attack the red planet. They're the ones that have been attacked, not us, right? Some of that evidence comes from pictures like this showing ancient river valley networks in some of the oldest parts of the planet and even some of the youngest parts where there are very few craters, very small scale evidence of water coming out of the shallow subsurface today. So we have this enigma, whereas the Mars we see today is a very inhospitable world, extremely cold temperatures, very low atmospheric pressure, very high ultraviolet radiation on the surface, so not a very nice place. But there's this story, this hypothesis, that perhaps if you were to turn the clock back 3 billion years, 4 billion years, maybe it was a much more Earth-like planet. And that hypothesis is one that drives much of NASA's and other space agencies' Mars exploration program. So that's kind of the basic context. We're going after that question, was it really Earth-like? Was it really a habitable environment, at least in places that we can explore in great detail? And we have to have tools to do that. Don't get me wrong, all of us would love to go and do some field work there. There'd be no better field trip in the world, right, than to go and test your hypothesis in person. We can't do that just yet. Those days are coming. We had an invigorating discussion among the panelists in a roundtable this afternoon talking about that topic and others. I'm an optimist. I believe that we are going to go to Mars. People will go, and it's only decades away. It's not centuries away. But for now, what we have to do is we have to send emissaries made out of silicon and copper and plastic and aluminum, titanium. And the emissaries are our spacecraft, our robotic spacecraft. Pictured here is the Spirit rover at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, kind of a golf cart-sized spacecraft. Just happens to have wheels, but it has a communication system, power system, computer system, scientific instruments, just like a spacecraft would be free-flying out in space. It's just driving across a planetary surface instead of free-floating. And you can sort of see the scale here, and solar powered, so a relatively modest size rover. And then the most recent member of this family, Curiosity, kind of the monster truck so far of Mars rovers, much larger vehicle, but of the same basic design and carrying the same basic kinds of scientific instruments, but augmented because it has a little bit more power available. Here's just a cartoon, just pointing out, you know, we have cameras up on the mast, different kinds of communication antennas to talk to the Earth, or we communicate directly with the orbiters around Mars. Each of the rovers has an arm, kind of like a human arm, and Spirit and Opportunity have a variety of spectrometers and microscopic imagers up there. The cameras that my group controls are up here on the mast, taking color pictures and panoramas, and that mast can spin around and look straight up and straight down. Curiosity, very similar, cameras up here. There's a laser instrument that can zap rocks and measure their chemistry. It's nuclear powered, not solar powered, so it uses the same kind of power supply as the Voyager space missions and the Viking space missions of the 70s. There's an arm here with a big turret on the arm with a microscope, an elemental chemistry Canadian instrument right there, and a drill to drill into the rock. Okay, so similar capabilities as the earlier vehicles, but beefed up. Primarily because of its size and range and power supply, but then inside here, we can't see, but inside the body, there are two very sophisticated laboratories, one to do very detailed measurements of the minerals that get delivered inside the rover from the drill process, and another, an isotope geochemistry laboratory, to look very, very carefully at the highest resolution we've yet looked on Mars for any sign of organic molecules or certain kinds of chemical signatures that could be consistent with the evidence of with the action of biology. So very sophisticated science payloads, kind of eyes and ears and other kinds of senses, but also a really important capability is mobility. This is what separates these vehicles from the Viking landers of the 70s, for example, or other landers that have gone to other places. Mobility is key to a geologist going out in the field. You get dropped off by helicopter somewhere in Alaska. You're going to run to the high ground quickly and do a survey. Just being able to move around is absolutely critical, and it's absolutely a critical part of these missions as well. So did a lot of testing. This rocker bogey suspension system got designed so that the rover can easily drive over obstacles up to about half of its height without having to stop. And they also have some sort of onboard smarts that help them avoid obstacles. So we knew going in, if Mars was covered in corrugated tin, we'd have no trouble driving around on the surface. And then where are you going to go? This is a two-slide summary of a five-year process with hundreds of people involved trying to figure out where to send these rovers. We know much more about the planet than we did back in the 70s when we were deciding where to send those landers. Now we've got all these high-resolution images and other kinds of measurements, and we decided for Spirit and Opportunity, since we had two chances and we're looking to test that idea of habitability, that we'd send Spirit to a place where the geology could be telling the story. It's a big hole in the ground. It's a crater that's called Gusev. It's about 150 kilometers across, so it's a big hole in the ground. And it has this beautiful valley, this dry valley that leads right into it, and no obvious outlet from that crater. So the hypothesis is that this may have been a crater lake, and it could be a great place to preserve sediments and other fine-grained deposits that are really good on our planet at preserving evidence of past biologic activity. And so sort of a geology beacon saying, hey, there was water here. It was a low-energy environment. Maybe you'll find some evidence of that habitability there. On the other side of the planet, Spirit's twin Opportunity went to a place where we saw this mineral signature. This color indicates the mineral hematite, Fe2O3, iron oxide, rust, if you will, which in the form that it was discovered here from orbit, on Earth, that material is often associated with liquid water. Water helps to form it. And it's a relatively safe and flat landing site, as you'll see in some of the pictures. So the hypothesis here was, hey, there's a mineral signature that's telling us that there may have been a watery environment and habitability may have been preserved there. Curiosity was sent to a place where there's kind of a combination of those two in one spot. Of course, we only had the one rover being sent this time instead of two, so we had to pick one spot. And we picked another hole in the ground, a crater called Gale, that is also about 150 kilometers across. We found a relatively safe, flat part of the crater floor where we could fit the landing ellipse to get in there. And I'll show you a movie about that landing. The cool thing about this crater, it has this big pile, this big mound of sediment inside of it. This is not just a central peak from an impact crater. It is a bunch of layered rock that's been laid down in sequence, and there are large canyons and gullies cut into it, and places where geologists, through the eyes of a rover, could go and try to read that geologic record. I'll show you some pictures of that. We'd land in a nice fan of material sent down from the rim so we could sample the rim. So land in the safe area, drive over up into the lower slopes of the mountain and climb the mountain here, going through these different layers of mineral signatures that were seen from orbit, including clay minerals, these particular clay minerals need water to form, liquid water to form, and many of them store that water still today in their structure. So being able to study them in detail would be outstanding. So these things, we work on them and we love them, and then we put them on rockets, which sounds kind of crazy, but you have to do that. You have to get them off the planet. And so Spirit and Opportunity were launched in the summer of 2003. They landed in 2004, and Curiosity was launched in late 2011 and landed in August 2012. The process of landing them is a crazy activity. And Mars eats spacecraft. About half of the spacecraft sent to Mars have failed by all of the various countries that have tried. It's one reason why the recent success of India in getting their very first attempted mission into orbit is notable. It's like good for them. They didn't crash like the rest of us did. So as all accounts are, that mission is starting off very well. So I want to show a movie that is a mixed, that's just about Spirit and Opportunity. It's a mixture of computer graphics that shows how those two rovers landed, and they used this spectacular airbag landing system. And it's a mixture of that computer graphics, because nobody was there on Mars to take their pictures as they were landing, but it's reconstructed from the actual telemetry, and live action shots of those of us who were at JPL, mostly the engineers who made this happen, who built the systems, who dedicated years of their life to making this happen. And you know, especially when I show this to kids, I say, you know, look at the faces of the people. You know, watch their reactions and imagine, you know, that you've been working on a project in school for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, just the same project, again and again. You come in and you're working on that project. The next day, the next year, move on to the next level. You're still working on that project, and as the project's getting close to being done, you have to kind of go in on weekends. And then all your friends have to come in and help you, and they're working on weekends and holidays, and nobody's taking any time off, and nobody's getting any sleep, and everybody's just really worried because the very end of that project, the teacher could just take it out of your hands and rip it up and throw it away. And the kids are like, whoa. And that's kind of the feeling that was going through people's minds as these rovers were heading down to the surface.
Light nav. Go nav. The Doppler signature indicates true stage separation has occurred.
Copy that. All systems are go for entry, descent, landing. We are roughly 11 minutes, 48 seconds from landing at the Gusev crater in the southern hemisphere of Mars. At this time, we'd like to invite you to sit back and enjoy the landing.
Atmospheric entry, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, mark.
The vehicle has now hit the top of the Martian atmosphere. The velocity will continue to increase for the next minute. We are now moving at a speed of 12,192 miles per hour. Downrange distance to landing site is 437 miles. Expect a parachute deploy in 5 seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1, mark. Current altitude should be approximately 25,000 feet. We are awaiting confirmation the parachute has deployed.
We see parachute has been detected.
Current altitude 8,000 feet. Moving at a speed of 173 miles per hour, we are near our terminal velocity.
Lander separation event has been detected.
The radar is in lock and we have a good solution on the ground. Expected retro rocket ignition on my mark. Mark. Waiting confirmation from the spacecraft that retro rocket ignition has occurred. At this point in time, we should be on the ground. Now 6 minutes 37 seconds from atmospheric entry, still waiting signal that we are on the ground.
No signal at the moment.
Deep Space Network tracking stations in Canberra and Goldstone are still searching for the primary signal. Stand by.
What do we see?
And a good evening from the flight deck of the Opportunity. At this time, we are approximately 5 minutes 53 seconds from landing at the Meridiani Plains near the equator of Mars. Over the next minute, we should begin to receive electronic tones from the spacecraft indicating a gradual deceleration. This time, parachutes should have deployed. We are awaiting confirmation that has occurred. Current altitude, 25,000 feet.
Parachute deploy has been detected.
We have positive indication of parachute deploy.
Semaphore has been detected.
Currently at an altitude of 18,000 feet. At this time, the radar should be active. We expect that the radar should lock on the ground in approximately 15 seconds from now. Current altitude, 11,000 feet. Current velocity, 180 miles per hour. Currently decelerating at 0.4 Gs. We expect that the airbags will inflate approximately 20 seconds from now. Current altitude, 4,000 feet.
Radar solution, matrix 21.
3,000 feet. The radar has a positive lock on the ground. We have a retro rocket firing solution. Retro rocket ignition on my mark. Mark. At this time, the retro rocket
has fired.
We have confirmation. Retro rocket has ignited. At this time, we are 5 minutes 55 seconds after entry. We should be bouncing on the ground. As the spacecraft is bouncing on the surface of Mars and rolling around, the antenna is pointed at many different orientations.
We're seeing it on the LCP. Very strong on LCP. We're on Mars, everybody.
The big burly guy kind of weeping at the end there. His name is Rob Manning. He's the guy who designed the airbags. So he was really happy. There's a guy, it was a white-haired man with a headset on at one point, and he kind of just went like this, right? He was the guy at NASA headquarters at the time who, if they crashed, he would have had to call the president. So he was really happy, too. Now, many of you hadn't seen that before, and you saw that airbag hit the ground, and you laughed. And I swear that's the same reaction we had on the science team first time we saw it. It's like, haha, that's funny. This is like some kind of a funny joke. We have to put our sensitive equipment and cameras and sensors. And you're going to throw it, and it's going to, yeah. Sure, okay, right. But my goodness, it worked. It worked twice. It really is a thrill and an honor to get to work with some of the best engineers on the planet, and those are the folks at JPL who are building and operating these things. Since we're telling jokes, okay, so you get a glass, 50% water in the glass, right? To an optimist, it's a glass half full. To a pessimist, it's a glass half empty. To an engineer, it's a glass twice as big as it needs to be. So let me tell you about Spirit, the first rover that landed in the middle of Gusev Crater here. And we spent more than 6 years driving across these plains into these hills, down the other side, past some sand dunes, into a place called Home Plate, because it kind of looks like the home plate on a baseball diamond, designed to last 90 Martian days. We lasted 2,210 and drove 7.7 kilometers across the surface for a pretty fruitful mission. Just very briefly, I'll tell you about what we did. Here's where we landed. Here's those airbags. This is an actual photo. The airbags, they got very dirty, very dusty. It's a very dusty place. It was one of our biggest problems with this landing site. It was very difficult to tell from orbit what was going on because of that dust. But we were very happy that we didn't land in a big pile of boulders or buried in the sand or something. We could use that mobility, and we looked wistfully at these hills off there several kilometers away. It's like, oh, that's beautiful. It'd be great to be up there, you know, but we're never going to get up there. You know, that's just too far away. And never, ever imagining we'd be cresting over this summit and driving down the other side within a year. So pretty cool stuff. And then the flip side, here's where the rover was. You saw the flower petals open in the movie. And so the rover was up here. It took that last picture from up here. Over the course of a couple of weeks, they drove it down these cloth ramps onto the ground, and then took a whole series of pictures for the engineers to figure out how the landing system worked. And you can see those deflated airbags. This is an alien artifact on another world. This is an alien artifact on another world. It does not belong there. It did not come from there. I believe it'll be part of the American Smithsonian Institution someday, off-planet. There'll be a red felt rope around here. Keep your kids off the lander. Very inspirational photo for the engineers who helped put this together. And you can tell a lot of this is not rocket science, really. It's sewing and cable tying and gears and motors and some, you know, good old-fashioned elbow grease to make these things happen. Huge range of skills to pull this all together. Here's a self-portrait of the end of the arm on the Spirit rover, the drilling and brushing device, the elemental chemistry device. This is sort of the working end for what I call the squiggly line science of the mission. And, you know, we take beautiful pictures, but much of the science comes from the squiggly lines. And these are all different kinds of ways to express reflection or emission of light at different wavelengths, or details of the structure, of the crystalline structure of a material, for example, different kinds of, you know, reflectance and emission spectroscopy, X-ray spectroscopy, Mossbauer spectroscopy, all of which can be used as fingerprinting tools on kind of an off-planet CSI forensic activity of trying to figure out what it is that we're seeing. So, you know, the pictures are what get promoted most in the public, but the pictures are helping to enable some rich detail and quantitative science that's happening to understand the chemistry and the kinds of minerals there and what those are telling us. What we were finding in the plains was all volcanic stuff, dry, bone-dry volcanic rock, which was a little frustrating. According to the media, this was an incredibly successful mission, right? But we had a depressed group of scientists out there because we were looking for that evidence of habitability, for that evidence of the action of water in the past or other processes, and we weren't finding it. And so thank goodness we had that mobility, because we used that mobility to drive up to those hills and over those hills. And here's a panorama taken from the summit of one of those hills, Husband Hill it was called. It's a very windy place. There's one of our solar panels getting dusty. But you see these little sand dunes here. Many of the rocks are scoured by wind acting over billions of years. You can see some little dust devils off in the horizon coming into view here. I guess, there they are, right there. And so it's a dynamic and windy place. Solar powered, dust settling out of the atmosphere over time. Go up on the ridge here into the wind, cleans the solar panels. Boom, all of a sudden we get a life again. We've been seeing the power sort of drop very slowly, and everybody was, you know, the end is coming. We're already, you know, 150 days into our 90-day mission here, and, you know, we've been lucky to live this far. Oh, well, nobody wanted to talk about it. Whoosh, the wind comes along, and you can't plan for that, right? So sometimes you get lucky in space exploration, and we've gotten lucky multiple times with both of these vehicles. So that was driving through these hills up here. We got into the hills and we started seeing the chemistry change, the minerals change. We started seeing evidence of the action of water altering some of that volcanic rock. And that compelled us to continue on to what we could see from orbit was this very interesting structure called home plate. And here we are down by the edge of it here. Here's the edge. It's about an 80-meter wide circular platform that's raised up about a meter and a half to 2 meters. And it's just chock full of layers. The edge of the platform is layered. It looks like, to everybody involved, it looks like the eroded remains of an ancient cinder cone, a volcanic feature formed when hot ash is erupting out of a volcanic vent and kind of building up this conical structure layer by layer by layer. There's even some places where it looks like some of the layers may have been wet, where rocks have deformed those layers as they were ejected out of the volcano. And this was really exciting because even though it's heavily eroded, it was an active hydrologic environment a long time ago. And on the Earth, hydrologic environments are very neat places for habitability. We had more pieces of the story by accidentally digging up some sulfur-rich soils. Spirit's right front rover stopped, right front wheel stopped working, and so we couldn't drive forward anymore. We had to drag the wheel backwards, and as we were dragging it, we were creating this deep trench that was digging up these minerals that we would not have seen otherwise. Again, some dumb luck, because they were covered by this layer of dust and soil. And they're loaded with sulfur in some places and loaded with silica in other places, and they're hydrated, and they're just the kinds of minerals that you often find in hydrothermal environments on the Earth. So We spent, this is why we spent more than 5 years driving the rover around this one feature. Most of Spirit's mission was spent here. You can see the yellow line going back and forth, up and down, across each part of it, looking for more of that mineral and geologic evidence for hydration and alteration. And so an analogy may be something like Grand Prismatic Hot Springs in Yellowstone National Park, where you have this hydrothermal source, water in the ground, forming alteration minerals, and you know the color here is from little buggies that live there, simple single-celled and other kinds of organisms. And so the question that we're still pondering is, you know, was this the kind of environment that existed there on Mars? There's lots of evidence that there was. We didn't finish our job, but it was getting dusty. Here's 2004 self-portrait, 2007 self-portrait, 2010 self-portrait. Where'd the rover go, right? Those solar panels getting dustier and dustier as that dust comes out of the atmosphere and the windstorms can't save us all the time. We eventually had low enough power that we got bogged down in some sand and didn't have enough power to get out. We kept trying for 3-4 weeks. You can see this kind of crusty sand that we broke through here. It turned out it was a little impact crater. We didn't recognize it. We're driving along and fell through the sand. And the power got to critically low levels because it was also winter, and we couldn't continue to drive. So the rover got stuck, kind of bogged down. And here's our last color picture taken, which was incredibly frustrating. There's all these cool layered rocks, different kinds of minerals here. And yet, we ran out of power. And so despite a free spirit movement on the internet that many of you may have participated in, we could not get the vehicle out of there. And so the mission ended in March of 2010. And it is a alien artifact on another planet. It's still there. We've seen it from orbit, from the orbiters. Nobody's stolen it. And it, too, will be part of, you know, a museum of the future, thinking about, you know, what we were doing back in our time. There'll be another red felt rope around here. Timmy, get off the rover! Very, very successful mission. And demonstrating and proposing a very good hypothesis that continues to be tested today, that this part of Mars was habitable to life as we know it, that it was warm, that it was wet, and that the environment was much more Earth-like. Very, very exciting discovery by the rover. So meanwhile, Opportunity is off on the other side of the planet at its landing site, still operating today, 3,804 days into our 90-day mission on Mars. Very, very successful, more than 10 years, more than 40 kilometers of driving, really using that mobility to drive from crater to crater to crater to crater. And now we're driving around the rim of this enormous 22-kilometer diameter crater that has clay minerals on its rim as seen from orbit. So we're studying those up close and personal. Our landing site was a little tiny hole in the ground called Eagle Crater, a little bit smaller than this room, actually, but the same airbag landing system. You can see them unfolded here. We drove off the cloth ramp, made kind of a mess in here. But the cool thing was we could see this outcrop in the walls of the crater instantly, and we had evidence in that material of the presence of water and the action of water. We drove off the rover. We saw the ground covered by these strange little grains of rock that were bluer than their surroundings, and we called them blueberries. They're a little smaller than blueberries, real blueberries, and they're not fruity. But they're strange and alien. What are they doing there? And so we looked to the literature of our own planet and found evidence for these kinds of features can be formed a variety of different ways involving impacts or volcanoes or alteration with groundwater. Tested each of those hypotheses with our squiggly line instruments and other measurements and have come to the conclusion that these are a kind of feature called a concretion, which is very much like a stalactite or a stalagmite in a cave. Mineral deposits that grow out of an evaporating solution. If it's happening inside of a rock that's porous and it's happening all nice and slow and uniform, the precipitation is spherical. And so this happens in the desert southwest of the U.S. and other places on our planet, for example. And we also saw evidence of sulfur-bearing minerals with water in them, other kinds of mineral and chemical signatures that tell us that there was water in this environment and it was a gentle sedimentary environment at one time, maybe like with sand dunes and near shore lakes, that kind of an environment, a long time ago. We don't have absolute age dating tools, so it's hard to know. We had to drive use our mobility to drive to other targets because you don't know if the one place you landed is weird or typical. So we asked the rover drivers, and there are licensed rover drivers at JPL. We asked them to take us into this bigger crater called Endeavour and take us down these slopes and over to this area of layer deposits here. Very challenging. And so they had to use the test rover at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to test going into the crater at these steep angles, going over obstacles and lips in the crater that we knew were there. So this is, simulates the mass distribution of the rover on Mars, simulating the gravitational forces that the rover would feel, taking a certain approach to go down the slope. Okay, that's bad, okay? Randy is not there on Mars to catch the rover if it does that. So I won't show the rest of this, but they, you know, being good engineers, they came at it at different angles and tried different ways to approach it and figured out how to get down there. So the tools on the ground were absolutely as critical as the real vehicle out in space. So we, you know, we're on the edge, getting ready to dip down with our giant pretend monster truck shadow. We had to be careful because the crater was full of sand dunes at the bottom, and that's a rover death trap. But they did get us in there, and we ended up getting just a spectacular view. We're on the inside of a bowl, tilted at 30 degrees, looking over our shoulder at these spectacularly layered rocks, which are loaded with the same kinds of hydrated sulfate and blueberries throughout these layers. So this whole stack of material, which used to be in the subsurface, is buried ancient sand dunes, has been inundated with water multiple times to do that alteration. So it has been, by all accounts, a habitable environment. We traveled to other craters and taken a variety of views of other spectacular landscapes with this vehicle. It really has been an incredibly photogenic, postcard-rich, I call them postcards, we call them that because many of them are the right aspect ratio. To be postcards. And many of us are, you know, you can sort of feel like you've got this friend that's on this exotic trip, right, going to these incredible sites, sending these postcards back every so often. We're on the rim of that big crater called Endurance that I mentioned, that 22-kilometer crater where we see the clay mineral deposits. We've been hunting for them over the past few months, over the past year. We found beautiful examples of gypsum-bearing veins. I've actually been up to Gypsumville here, not too far away, and to study some analogs for this kind of material with a colleague of mine from Winnipeg. And we're seeing evidence of those kinds of minerals and these clay, likely clay-filled coatings on many of the rocks. And so we think that the clay signature may represent water alteration of that primary rocky material. So we're about there today. It's all 3804. We're continuing to explore the southern part of the rim of the crater. We're up here by a small crater, and our plan is to continue to drive along this front here, where from orbit we see lots of cool evidence of other kinds of clay minerals and geology. So we're continuing that mission very actively. It is just some recent examples of pictures, this beautiful panorama we took a week and a half or so ago, looking back over part of the crater rim. So we do a lot of photogenic work that helps set the geologic context. And then this is a picture that just came down, I downloaded it this morning on my laptop from the hotel. We're seeing more of that kind of platy coatings that are indicative of the kinds of clay minerals that we're seeing. So this mission continues to operate well. It's not as much of a dusty place, and so the solar panels are not getting as dusty as Spirit did. How long will it keep going? No one knows. When kids ask me that question, I say, how long will your toaster keep working? And they said, just look at me like I'm dumb. And they say, you know, I don't know. And I say, well, you're going to keep making toast, right? And that's exactly what we're doing. We're going to keep making toast with our Energizer Bunny Opportunity Mars rover going for now 5 Mars years and still roving. And then finally, there's Curiosity. I have another movie here, and it's going to push me over time, but I'm compelled to show it because, Joe, you were asking about it, if you want me to. It's the 7 Minutes of Terror movie. Should I show it? Should I show the movie? Should I skip it? Yes. Okay.
When people look at it, it looks crazy. That's a very natural thing. Sometimes when we look at it, it looks crazy. It is the result of reasoned engineering thought. But it still looks crazy. From the top of the atmosphere, down to the surface, it takes us 7 minutes. It takes 14 minutes or so for the signal from the spacecraft to make it to Earth. That's how far Mars is away from us. So when we first get word that we've touched the top of the atmosphere, the vehicle has been alive, we're dead on the surface for at least 7 minutes.
Entry, descent, and landing, also known as EDL, is referred to as the 7 minutes of terror, because we've got literally 7 minutes to get from the top of the atmosphere to the surface of Mars, going from 13,000 miles an hour to zero, in perfect sequence, perfect choreography, perfect timing, and the computer has to do it all by itself with no help from the ground. If any one thing doesn't work just right, it's game over.
We slam into the atmosphere and develop so much aerodynamic drag. Our heat shield, it heats up and it glows like the surface of the sun. 1600 degrees.
During entry, the vehicle is not only slowing down violently through the atmosphere, but also we are guiding it like an airplane to be able to land in a very narrow constrained space. This is one of the biggest challenges that we're facing, and one that we have never attempted on Mars.
Mars is actually really hard to slow down because it has just enough atmosphere that you have to deal with it. Otherwise, it will destroy your spacecraft. On the other hand, it doesn't have enough atmosphere to finish the job. We're still going about 1,000 miles an hour. So at that point, we use a parachute.
The parachute is the largest and strongest supersonic parachute that we've ever built to date. It has to be able to withstand 65,000 pounds of force, even though the parachute itself only weighs about 100 pounds.
When it opens up that fast, it's a neck-snapping 9 Gs.
At that point, we have to get that heat shield off. It's like a big lens cap blocking our view of the ground to the radar. The radar has to take just the right altitude and velocity measurements at just the right time, or the rest of the landing sequence won't work.
This big, huge parachute that we've got, it'll only slow us down to about 200 miles an hour. And that's not slow enough to land. So we have no choice, but we've got to cut it off and then come down in rockets. Once we turn those rocket motors on, we don't do something, we're just going to smack right back into the parachute. So the first thing we do is make this really radical divert. We fly off to the side.
Diverting away from the parachute, killing our horizontal velocity and our vertical velocity, getting the rover moving straight up and down so it can look at the surface with its radar and see where we're going to land. And we head straight down to the bottom of the crater, right beside a 6 kilometer high mountain.
We can't get those rocket engines too close to the ground, because if we were to descend propulsively with our engines all the way to the ground, we would essentially create this massive dust cloud. That dust cloud could then go and land on the rover. It could damage mechanisms and it could damage instruments. So the way we solve that problem is by using the sky crane.
20 meters above the surface, we have to lower the rover below us on a tether that's 21 feet wide, and then gently deposit it on its wings, on the surface.
As the rover touches down and is now on the ground, the descent stage is in a collision course with the rover. We must cut the bridle immediately and fly the descent stage to a safe distance from the rover.
Never gonna work. Lauren, is it ever gonna work? It's never gonna work, right? It's crazy. He was there. Unbelievable. Again, spectacular engineering. Too heavy for those airbags, so they had to stuff it into this combination parachute and kind of Viking lander system. Got down to the surface safely into that big hole, took our first pictures. We could see places where those retro rockets were scouring the ground, and that turned out to be somewhat fortuitous because in those places where the ground was exposed, we were seeing these conglomerate kind of almost like poured cement deposits, like you'd be going out to break up the old basketball court in your backyard, you know, and seeing those rounded pebbles in there, and that cementing agent is telling us that there was a lot of liquid water here. Dust cannot move, wind cannot move rocks that size, cannot round them the way that these are. We need water to form the cement that's cementing them all together. We still don't know what that cement is, by the way. We're still working hard to figure that out. So instantly, upon landing almost, we made our first discovery, and that is that the floor of this crater had flowing water across its surface, probably coming down that fan from the walls of the crater and flowing for significant distances to round the rocks and at significant velocities to transport that much material, probably ankle deep or knee deep at least, maybe more. Don't know exactly when, but it was there, and it's like, oh, this definitely could have been a habitable environment. Let's see what else we can figure out. So we used the rest of that toolkit that we brought along to take pictures and take other measurements. A key component of that is the laser instrument. This is called laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy. It's a way to remotely do elemental chemistry. So we got ready and fired our first laser shot. There it is. So that's a joke, right? We didn't really do that. We didn't blow up Mars. We made a tiny little pit, 100 microns or so across. But from that pit, this vapor comes out, which lets us do the squiggly line science, giving us the elemental chemistry in great detail all across the periodic table, which with geochemical modeling can be used to figure out what kinds of materials are there. So lots of squiggly line science and quantitative work being done by Curiosity. Lots of great imaging. More examples of fine layered stratigraphy. There, putting the pieces of the story together, we have a team of geologists. Our project scientist, John Grossinger, is one of the best stratigraphic geologists in the world, and he's now applying his expertise to understanding Mars. The cameras help us to figure out where to point the laser and shoot it to get at the chemistry, and we see these beautiful little veins, again, gypsum and sulfur-rich, indicating that water was flowing not just across the surface, but in the ground. There was a groundwater system here. How do we get underground? We put the arm down and we drill into the surface. And when we drilled into the surface for the first time, all of a sudden, and for the first time, it wasn't red Mars anymore. It was gray Mars. The subsurface just below that layer of dust and soil is not oxidized, and it's loaded with clay-bearing minerals, including some of the water that formed those clays still inside those clays. So, again, pretty quick discovery that this was a potentially habitable environment because of the mineralogy and the geochemistry. We've experienced a bunch of wheel damage from these very, very tough rocks and these cements that were driving across these conglomerates. It was unanticipated, so we've had to modify our approach, turning into a dune buggy, driving over sand more than rock as much as possible. So self-inspection with the rover camera is a critical part of our activity. Here's the part of the selfie. You guys have seen the selfie. The Curiosity took several of them now, pointing the camera up, you know, looking at our head. And these are the cameras that I helped to run from ASU, the color cameras up there, built by Malin Space Sciences in San Diego. This has, I think, inspired some art. Here's sort of the Andy Warhol view of that. And then this one is my favorite. It's kind of like, you know, there's Curiosity and there's Spirit Opportunity. Kind of love it. So we've traveled on the order of more than 5 kilometers now across the plains from our landing site, and we are now into the base of this mountain. You can't see this. The slope starts to head uphill right in here. So we've arrived at the base of this mountain, and here's the view from the surface. You can see these layered deposits in here. Okay, this is not a crater central peak. There may be a central peak buried under there, but there has been a process that over time has deposited 4.5 kilometers of sediment inside this hole in the ground, filling the hole up with that sediment at one point and now eroding it away over the past few billion years. So we're going to be driving up into into this, and just for scale, there's the size of the rover. So this is an enormous, enormous mountain in front of us. Just another view here. You can see that there have been dramatic changes in the geology, flat line, tilted. So there's some kind of an unconformity here. Some time has passed. Processes have changed. Big change. Every one of these layers represents some environmental change. That's why geologists love layers. That's why you go to places like the Grand Canyon and you read the story. It's preserved there. That's why this place was chosen as the landing site. There's some pictures from this past week and some beautiful sand dunes from yesterday. You know, again, we try to drive on these more than the rocks to keep the wheels from getting more damaged. And here is where we've done our first drilling into the base of this mountain, and here's a before and after. We drilled into that little plate right there. You can see it's kind of cracked up rock, and a close-up of the drill hole with the microscope. So this material in here has now been transported into the rover, and I wish I could tell you what it's made of, but the analysis is happening right now. So we'll all find out very soon. Very excited to see if there's more evidence of clay minerals or other kinds of materials that could tell us not just about the presence of water, but maybe about the pH of that water. Was it acidic? Was it neutral? What we have so far from the other drill holes suggests more neutral fresh water compared to what Opportunity saw in Meridiani with those sulfates, more acidic water. So the biologists and the astrobiologists care about the acidity. Our plan is to, so we're up here now, we're going to make our way through these sand dunes and sample all these different formations here which have different mineral signatures as we go up. And we're hoping, you know, we've got 4.5 kilometers potentially to climb, but it's really the bottom 500 meters that's the most rich in terms of the geology and the chemistry. So very active mission going on there, and just stay tuned, follow along online with what's going on. Just very briefly, what's going on in the future? So there's been this progression of NASA Mars rovers from Mars Pathfinder 97, Spirit and Opportunity in 2004, Curiosity in 2012. The obvious next step, of course, is this. No, that'd be cool, but no. The next step is 2020. Basically, a copy of the basic design of Curiosity will be sent in 2020. Payload was just selected. We'll run the cameras from ASU on those, but there's a variety of spectrometers, ground-penetrating radar. There's a small experiment from MIT, actually, to try to pull oxygen out of the air to demonstrate the capabilities for future human exploration, high-resolution cameras, et cetera. The difference between this mission and Curiosity, it's using many of Curiosity's spare parts. The payload is different because this mission is designed to cache a bunch of samples, maybe 30 to 50 samples, put them in a special little container and make that container available for some future mission to go get and bring back to the Earth. So it's designed to be the first part of a Mars sample return mission. And it's part of this long-term program of Mars exploration that NASA and other space agencies are doing to test that hypothesis. Was Mars habitable? The places that we've tested it so far, we've gotten positive answers. We don't know if Mars was inhabited. That evidence, if it's there, is much harder to find. It may be deep, deep underground. I'll say that there's nothing inconsistent. What we know about Mars, there's nothing inconsistent with there being ecosystems deep underground. We don't know the geothermal heat gradient. That's one thing this mission in 2016 is designed to measure. We don't know how warm it gets as you go underground. We know there's a lot of ice there. How much of it is water? Is there a groundwater system? Is there a flourishing biomass under the ground on Mars as there is on the Earth? We don't know the answer. It's definitely possible. So I'll just end with this slide that shows some URLs, places to go, a spectacular blog, of course, at the Planetary Society on what's happening with this mission and JPL's website. We're having a blast finding habitable environments off of this planet. Thank you so much. Advancing your slides, just put it in your USB.
Well, while we're getting set up here, I'd like to add my thanks to Jim's, to the organizers, and to Lauren Trottier and his family, and all of you here at McGill for inviting us to be here. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward. Yes, fingers crossed, it's going to work. It always works. except when it doesn't. But I'm here tonight. I'm here on a mission, right? I'd like you to leave this auditorium with a perspective that's different than the one that you walked in from. I'm going to talk about searching not... Well, something's happening. Okay, let's go here. Right. I'm going to talk about looking for technosignatures. That is, looking for evidence of someone else's technology, looking for extraterrestrial intelligence. And you might think that that's really far out, fringe man, right? But I actually think it's incredibly important to our future. This is a mission. This is a project that can, in fact, help us to have a long future. So the story of us began billions of years ago. We've come through this long process of cosmic evolution, and that seems so far away and so long ago that it couldn't possibly really relate to us. But you're intimately connected with that history, because it takes a cosmos to make a human. Here is the remnant of a massive star that lived its life and ended in a catastrophic explosion, leaving behind remnants. This happened for us about 8 billion years ago. The iron atoms in the hemoglobin molecules in your blood were cooked up inside a massive star that did this explosive death throes, leaving behind remnants that eventually then coalesced and condensed into our solar system, planets, and then life. Thank you. So, what we understand now is that we live on a very fragile island of life in a universe of possibilities. And I think that it's important to our future here on Earth to really embrace that larger perspective and understand the possibilities. Now, as we pry open the door of the cosmos, we're testing these possibilities, and Jim has just shown you this marvelous exploration of the surface of our nearest neighbor. And as he said, these rovers were not intended to find life, but to find whether or not the conditions that we think are necessary for life, at least life as we know it, to find whether they existed, and the answer is yes. Whether there's actually life on Mars under the surface or not is an open question. Perhaps we have to go farther out in our solar system looking for biomarkers. We're interested in exploring the very large moons of Jupiter, Ganymede, Callisto, Europa, and Saturn's large moon, Titan. In the icy moons of Jupiter, we think that beneath that icy outer crust, there are liquid, water, salty oceans, and that's been there for billions of years. On Europa, a moon about the size of our moon, we think there's probably twice as much water as in the oceans of Earth. And some scientists suggest that the origin of life on this planet was
in the ocean, and perhaps that same sort of process has happened on Europa as well. On Titan, we're not so much looking for liquid water, we're actually interested in exploring the liquid lakes that are on the surface of Titan that are made out of ethane and methane. This might be the kind of primitive organic chemistry in the early solar system that might tell us about the origin of life. And you know, there's this funny little tiny moon of Saturn called Enceladus. Wouldn't have thought much about this moon until the spacecraft orbiting Saturn caught this picture of the south polar regions of that small icy moon Enceladus, where we see these plumes, these cryovolcanoes that are containing perhaps liquid water ices, not liquid, water ice and organics. And we now think the same sort of thing is happening on Europa. So maybe if we want to sample the oceans of Europa, we don't have to get through the kilometers of ice. Maybe we can just fly through and pick up a sample and bring it back to see what lies beneath the ice. Now, this is within our own solar system. If we were to find a second genesis, a second independent origin of life here in this one small solar system, we would know that life is ubiquitous out there. So N of 2, the second example, is really important in this story. And maybe there isn't any other evidence of an origin of life beyond Earth within the solar system. Maybe we have to consider other planets around other stars. This is a spacecraft called Kepler, launched in 2009. Kepler's whole reason for being is to find small Earth-sized planets in orbit around distant stars. And Kepler does that by looking here. Can you see that tiny, I can't see it. Right there, see that tiny dot? That's a planet transiting its star. And as it transits in front of the star, it dims the light from the star very, very slightly. And we can notice that with Kepler. And that spacecraft has been staring for slightly over 4 years. It stared at this one area on the sky, about 100 square degrees, size of your hand at the end of your arm. And Kepler kept track of the light from 170,000 stars, continuously monitoring, looking for one of them to wink, to get a little bit dimmer. And when it did, Kepler remembered that. And then it waited to see if it happened again. If it did, Kepler said, that might be a planetary period. I wonder if it's going to happen a third time. Yes, if it does, now Kepler is quite interested and continues to study these stars, piling up the data, transit after transit, in search of extrasolar planetary systems. And indeed, out of these 170,000 stars, Kepler found that 4,234 of them blinked in this periodic fashion. And we call them exoplanet candidates. Some of them are bright enough to have been looked at by ground-based observing and confirmed. Others have been confirmed by the statistics of Kepler itself. So we now know from studying this one small area on the sky and projecting that across the rest of the galaxy that almost every star will have planets, at least one. And some of those planets are a little bit more interesting than others. They're the planets that happen to be at exactly the right distance from their star. So they're not too hot and not too cold. We think that if these planets had an atmosphere, they might have liquid water on their surface. And we have this real chauvinistic bias for liquid water, because liquid water is absolutely essential for life as we know it. And so these planets in the habitable zone, these Goldilocks planets, are of particular interest. And you know, I think we're getting to the point where our enthusiasm is maybe outrunning the data that we actually have. We've begun to make a list of the most habitable planets, the most Earth-like planets that we've found. But Kepler can tell us the size of the planet, and if we use ground-based observations that look at how the planet tugs its star backwards and forwards, then perhaps we can get the mass of the planet. Well, with the size and the mass, we can get the density. And because we think we know the spectral type of the star, and we know how far away the planet is, we think we can figure out the temperature. But this is about all we know. We have sizes, we have some densities, and we have calculated temperatures for these bodies. And yet we are going and getting so excited about habitable planets and habitability. And as Sarah will tell you tomorrow, this is a really difficult subject to tease out what's really going on. There's a lot of degeneracy. A planet of a particular mass, radius, and density could have a number of different compositions. But some of these are really beginning to look very Earth-like. In particular, this past year, there was the announcement of the detection of the first Earth-sized planet within the habitable zone of its star. And maybe this is really a habitable world. But we've got a lot of work to do before we can demonstrate that. And we're in the position of having, again, an N of one. We know about one habitable world that's inhabited, ours. And we knew up until 1995, actually 93 if we count the pulsar planets, Vicki, but 1995, we didn't know about any other planets in any other solar system. So, of course, what did we do? We made them in our computer. We simulated what other planetary systems were going to be like. And, you know, strangely, they came out looking just like ours, right? All of the planets ran around in circular clockwork orbits, and the big gas giants were on the outside, and the little rocky planets were on the inside. And it was a big wake-up call for all of us when the very first planet we detected was a giant planet so close to its star that it went around the star every 4.3 days. Oh, that's not like us. And so the marvelous thing that Kepler has been showing us is that we've not only found stars with one planet, but we've found stars with many planets. And we've had now all of these different examples of different ways to build planetary systems. And we've learned that planets don't stay where they're born. They move in and they move out. And it's just a fantastic opportunity to understand more the physics of how planetary systems form and evolve, because we have more than an example of one. Now, with respect to life, we're still sitting here with an example of only one, and we should remember our experience with trying to build planetary systems from a single example. when we think about life, life somewhere else, life as we don't yet know it, we shouldn't be so absolutely constrained by what we already know. We should be open for other possibilities, yet understanding that life as we know it makes a great deal of sense if you start with a cosmos whose atomic inventory, whose elemental inventory is what we have. Carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus, those are really abundant, and they make a lot of sense in terms of turning chemistry into biology. But indeed, something else might also be possible. And we shouldn't exclude that opportunity as we go looking for life beyond Earth. And we also need to be mindful that we have historically adopted this funny view of evolution where somehow humans are the pinnacle of evolution. We're the top of the heap. Well, indeed, we're not. We're just one tiny twig on a very well-populated tree or bush of life. And although we now understand at the molecular level the basis for evolution, which has populated all of these different branches to be perfectly suited for the niches that they occupy, we still in our minds haven't gotten over this putting us on top. But it's a sense of privilege that the natural universe actually doesn't share. So as we start thinking about life somewhere else, we really have to rethink the context of that search. We have to think about here and now. And what really is here? What is now? Well, clearly, we're here, right? Here we are in this lovely auditorium, and we're all familiar with Google Earth, and that puts Montreal right here. And if you were at the altitude of low Earth orbiting satellites, you'd see us here. And since 1968, when Bill Anders and Apollo 8 took this image, we've begun to appreciate our island universe floating in space. And some of us in the audience have had the opportunity to actually see that. And I'm so jealous. I would love to have done that. The Cassini spacecraft orbiting Saturn looked back and saw us here. That's actually us, that little white dot. And in 1980, as the Voyager 1 spacecraft was passing Neptune on its way out of the solar system, it looked home and it saw us here. This is the pale blue dot. This is us. And of course, our planetary system, our solar system, is located here on the outskirts, the boondocks of a grand spiral galaxy that contains maybe 400 billion other stars. And that galaxy is one of 100 billion or more other galaxies within our observable universe. So here's the context of where we are. This is really what we mean by here. And as you look at this beautiful image from the Hubble telescope, you're reminded that looking farther out in space at these fainter and fainter galaxies, you're looking farther and farther back in time. And so we have to appreciate our now as being embedded in this long 13.8 billion year evolution of our cosmos. So that's where we are. That's here. That's now. And the amazing thing is, although we've been studying this, looking at the universe, marveling at the images that we've seen through telescopes and on photographs, it's only just recently that we've understood that all of this that we've been studying is only about 4% of what's actually out there. most of the universe is dark energy, dark matter. Dark's just a code word for we haven't a clue. We don't know what it is. Either that or we really don't understand gravity. There's a lot here to be learned. So I'd like you to take away the idea that we, all of us, really are the living and breathing products of billion-year lineage of wandering stardust, right? We are what happens when a primordial mixture of hydrogen and helium evolves for so long that it begins to wonder where it came from. We are stardust. And in that context, it makes more sense than ever to ask, is it really just us? Are we really alone in this colossal sea of matter and energy and chemistry and physics? Well, with homage to a pretty good science fiction film from about 15 years ago, if we are, it seems like an awful waste of space. So, but what if we're not alone? What if somebody out there, someone else is asking and answering the same sorts of questions? Someone's looking up at the night sky, the same sky, but just from the opposite side. Might the discovery of an older cosmic culture inspire us to find a way to survive our increasingly uncertain technological adolescence? Think about that. So, about 50 years ago, our human journey to find answers to these questions took a different turn. We began using some tools to try and conduct an exploratory science that we called the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. As a misnomer, what we can do is look for technology, use that as our proxy for intelligence, and perhaps succeed in finding the technologists. And we started with radio telescopes, but today we use optical telescopes, and we are listening and looking for someone else's technology. Our own technology is detectable over interstellar distances, and perhaps theirs is as well. Perhaps a vast communication network, some shield against asteroids, or something that we can't yet begin to imagine, but something still that would be detectable with a systematic enough exploration. And whether or not this exploration will be successful depends on whether there have ever been any other technological civilizations, and most of all, how long they survive. Because think about our here and our now. We are a very young technology, maybe 100 years if you're talking about electromagnetic signaling, 100-year-old technology in a galaxy that's 10 billion years old. So if any two technologies are going to discover one another, they not only have to be close enough in space to be detectable with the sensitivities of the instruments that are available, but they have to be lined up in this very deep time. And if technologies last 100 years, that's never going to happen. But if technologies, in fact, on average, are long-lived, then it is possible to have a successful SETI program. We might detect someone else. So Phil Morrison had a wonderful way of summarizing this thought. He calls SETI the archaeology of the future, in fact, of our future. If we detect a signal, and if there's some information content, because of the finite speed of light and the huge distances between the stars, any information in that signal will be telling us about their past. But the fact that we made a detection tells us that on average technologies last for a long time. Someone else made it through, so can we. So we're building new tools to do this search, and this is a series of images of the Allen Telescope Array in Northern California. We have now 42 small telescopes that we array together with a lot of silicon technology to make a larger telescope. We'd like eventually to grow this to 350 telescopes. And the great thing about doing SETI today is that we're riding an exponential. We can grow in capability by increasing the collecting area, but we also grow in capability by increasing the computing capacity. And Moore's Law is leading us ahead. So as opposed to the images that Jim showed you of Mars, this is the way Mars sometimes looks to our instruments. We're looking for obviously engineered signals as opposed to astrophysical signals. And I think you can see some patterns there that really don't look very natural, even if I don't tell you what the axes are, but we're plotting frequency horizontally and time vertically. And sometimes when both the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Mars Express are on this side of the planet, we get to see their transmitters. And this is the kind of artifact that we're looking for in the radio. When we talk about optical, we're looking for very short, bright optical flashes that might be somebody else's lasers. And if you'd like to follow along with the observations that we're doing at the SETI Institute at the Allen Telescope Array, we've got a website, SETIQuest.org, that John Richards has put together. You can see that was last night's observing schedule. When we're not on the air, Inspector Clouseau is sitting there drumming his fingers, but now you see this young woman who's searching the sky actively, so we're on the air. This was last night's progress on the observations. And if you want to actually be involved real time, take out your iPhone and a Distant Suns application will allow you to click on the radio telescope and see the three extrasolar planetary systems that we're observing at any moment, mostly the Kepler systems and the other exoplanets detected from the ground. And that's what we're doing at the Allen Telescope Array, but there's more SETI on the telescopes today. UC Berkeley has a very active SETI program. SETI at Home was an early distributed computing application that millions of people downloaded. I mean, it wasn't that SETI at Home invented distributed computing, but it was just such a sexy application that it really put it on the map and launched all these wonderful citizen science opportunities now to use your computer to do real science with real data. So SETI, the SETI at Home data are being collected at Arecibo, the large telescope in Puerto Rico, and this Berkeley program has begun observing with the Green Bank telescope. That's all offline processing. And the LOFAR telescope, which is coming online at much lower frequencies, is beginning to try and scan the sky in real time for lower frequency, perhaps even transient signals. There's an effort in Italy at the Medicina 64-meter telescope. There's a program outside the gates at the Deep Space Network, where the Gabbard Apple Valley Radio Telescope is using an old NASA telescope to begin to do a sky survey with students. So it's a student project. And in Japan, they have begun to try and organize simultaneous observations of radio, using radio and optical telescopes around the world to look at the same objects. In the optical, most optical studies being done at university environments. It's kind of the 1 meter class telescopes that are being used. There's a sky survey going on at Harvard. This shows Shelley Wright, who left the U.S. and came to Canada. She was a professor at the University of Toronto for a number of years. This is the first optical SETI telescope detector that she built, and she's now building another one. Unfortunately, she's left Canada, and we get to claim her again at the University of California, San Diego. And then there's an Italian optical SETI project called FOAM. 13 and a small optical telescope outside of Sydney at Campbelltown. What we'd like to do in the optical SETI is move it into the infrared. At optical wavelengths, there's dust and obscuration, scattering, and absorption. As you go into the infrared, you can see an optical signal farther. And so here's Shelley Wright working on a new infrared SETI detector. Here's an interferometer that Charlie Towns built on Palomar. And here are some ideas for future searches. When we're looking for not particular artifacts or signals, but simply the waste heat of any advanced civilization that's using a lot of power. So this is the Colossus telescope on the left that's being proposed by Jeff Kuhn at the University of Hawaii. He's hoping to find the waste heat radiated from the back of things like Dyson spheres to collect all the energy of a star and use it for technological purposes. And we're doing right now a small approach to that, going through the data that was collected by the WISE telescope, looking for bright infrared sources. And in the future, well, there's JWST, which we hope will launch in 2018. And there is equipment on board, cameras and spectrometers, that may, in fact, be able to analyze the atmospheres of a few exoplanets around very nearby stars that we can image, and we may be able to see the telltale signs of biology on the surface. And I'm sure Sarah will talk a lot more about this tomorrow. And as for SETI, well, we'd like to put optical SETI on bigger pieces of glass. So the 30-meter telescope and the European Extremely Large Telescope. And in radio, the square kilometer array, which we hope will be built in the next decade or two. All of this is all about a message to us, as well as looking for a message from them. As you think about here and now, as you think about the context I've tried to set for you, imagine us and imagine them. It's like holding up a mirror to the earth and saying, you there, you're all the same when compared to someone else out there. It's SETI and the participation in this kind of exploratory science trivializes the differences among humans that we're willing to spread and shed blood over. I think ultimately, even if SETI does not succeed, trying to propagate this idea, this cosmic perspective, this meme of being an Earthling, and propagating that meme across the globe in a cooperative exploratory project, I think may in fact help us to manage the challenges that do not respect national borders, may help us to deal with global climate change, help us to find ways to stabilize our water and our food supplies, to manage this planet and our population in a way that can help us to reach a long future as a technological civilization. And hopefully we can grow old and we can discover whatever the rest of the stardust in our universe has turned into. Thank you.
If you would like to watch the movie Contact, it's available on the web. It's very easy to find. All you have to do is say, watch movie Contact, and it comes up. I don't know how it does. It's probably the result of all of the technology that you've heard about, and you can watch it in full color, perfect movie, and you'll see Jodie Foster's interpretation of Jill's life. Spoiler coming up. In the movie, of course, Hollywood being Hollywood, the signal actually does come. And it's very interesting on what happens, because it just might happen like that if the signal really does come. I think we've been certainly well informed and entertained by the fantastic movies and the saga of looking for life out there. And I suspect that there are some questions that come up. We would like questions, but not speeches. So please, if you do have a question, approach the mic, and hopefully it's a question that can be answered very quickly. We're not looking for elaborate discussions. Yes.
Several years ago, a prominent reporter asked a prominent philosopher what the latter's reaction would be if he ever got a call from an alien life form in space. And the philosopher answered, given that human history has shown that whenever different civilizations meet, there's an inevitable clash, and one of them disappears, he said he'd likely hang up. So my question is, why would our two distinguished scientists disagree with that philosopher? Do you really think that our human institutions, political, economic, social, have kept pace with our technological and scientific advances?
Well, not so far. I think we have, and we can do a lot better. But when you think of long times, when you think of a long future, when you think of another technological civilization that has somehow managed to grow old, they've had to get over all of the kinds of problems that an emerging technology allows to happen. So I think that knowing that it's possible to be an old technology is motivation for us to get there. We're not there by any chance, by any ways now. David Deutsch, a very well-known cosmologist who suddenly decided to think about climate, says if he had two tablets on which he could engrave, stone tablets on which he could engrave words of wisdom or guidelines, he would engrave, problems are soluble on one, and problems are inevitable on the other. And so I think if we could go forward knowing that there is some solution to the problems and the non-functional institutional organizations that we have today, if you know there's a solution, I think you should be motivated to work on finding it. So
I'll just add that this, of course, was a central question in Carl Sagan's book, Contact. We have much to learn. I think many people who are involved in SETI and supporters of SETI, like members of the Planetary Society, are optimists, and we have great hope for the future of our species.
Thank you.
Yes, in the back.
It's always hard to have a sense of things that are counted in hundreds of billions. So when you talk about hundreds of billions of stars in a galaxy and then hundreds of billions of galaxies, can you sort of put in an earthly scale, you know, from Montreal to where, how far out can you see to this point? If, as far as you can calculate as far as you can calculate in the universe being halfway around the world, about how far out can you see?
Okay, do you want to do that mental calculation in your head?
I know one. It's not exactly that answer, but it's just an analogy. There are more stars in the Milky Way than grains of sand.
No, that's 10 to the 22.
Isn't it
10 to the 23, right?
What's that one?
Number of stars in the universe, right?
Yeah.
Equal to the number of grains of sand on the beaches of the Earth. But you want to know how far we can see. Well, there is
We can only see a certain way. There is actually an observable edge to the universe. And that's how far light can have traveled in 13.8 billion years. Right? We can't know about anything beyond that. So we have this observable horizon. And you want me to scale that to the distance around the globe and how far from Montreal?
We need more wine.
I think, yes. More wine, please.
Not precisely.
But we're beginning. I mean, it's amazing. The Hubble Ultra Deep Field, the results from looking at the fluctuations of the cosmic microwave background. We're actually seeing back to a time when the universe was only a few hundred thousand years old. It's quite spectacular. And there is a dark ages because the universe was opaque. We can't really penetrate back farther than that. And of course, you go back to 10 to the minus 35 seconds, a Planck time, and our physics doesn't work. Right at the very beginning, we can't make gravity and quantum mechanics play nice together. So our physics breaks down at the very first instances. But observationally, as you get a little bit, a universe that's a little bit older, there's an amazingly consistent story of how we think the cosmos evolved, and there's more to be learned.
I was always intrigued by Carl Sagan's comment about more stars in the universe than grains of sand on all the Earth's beaches. Not particularly about the stars, but how one would know the grains of sand on the Earth's beaches. Because I actually tried once. I took a handful of sand and I tried to count, and it's almost an impossible thing to do. But what I can tell you is that I got to roughly 1,000 and there was no discernible difference in what I was holding. So
actually, I think, strangely enough, the astronomical estimate of the number of stars in the observable universe may be more accurate than the calculation of the number of grains of sand on Earth. It's very hard. Sand grains are not uniform in size. They don't pack in evenly.
That's a real hard calculation. Try counting grains
of sand.
We're
very happy to bring some geology to this cosmology conversation.
There you go.
I had a question on the WOW signal. I wanted to know, sort of with, I guess, 30 or 40 years of history after that spike in some radio telescope, I guess in Ohio somewhere, whether that keeps you guys going, whether that's frustrating, what's sort of the emotion that generated in the SETI community, the WOW signal?
Well, for those that haven't heard about it, the WOW signal was detected by the Ohio State University Radio Observatory in the 1980s when our computer technology was not what it is today. All this computer could do as the telescope was staring at the sky that was going overhead was to write down numbers that indicated what the total power in a few spectral channels was at that moment. And then weeks later, someone came and picked up all the printout and looked at it. And one day, the person who came to collect the data saw this enormous spike coming from one position on the sky, more energy, more power than they had ever seen before. He circled it and he wrote, "Wow!" But what was it? It's frustrating to me as a scientist because we have to try and figure out how to distinguish between their signals and our own technology. And Ohio State had set up a protocol where in this one telescope, which basically stood still and the sky drifted over, there were two receivers, one east and one west. So a proper signal would have first showed up in the east receiver, gone away, and then showed up in the west receiver. The WOW signal didn't quite make it. What they know is there was
signal in one of the receivers for the whole time and in the other receiver for just a portion of the time. So it didn't actually pass their protocol. Nevertheless, so much power. They were excited. Everybody got excited. Lots and lots of telescope time has been used to try and find this signal again, to no avail. So it may have been a real ET signal that was transient. You know, they kind of pinged, and then they went on and pinged there and pinged there, and they haven't come back again. Or it might have been our own technology. And so I have to say that my whole career has been spent trying to build observing protocols and strategies that do the signal processing in real time or near real time, so we won't have a wow signal that we can't explain.
Okay, to the back, please. To the back.
One of the things both of you talk about repeatedly is sort of collaboration.
Can you get closer to the microphone?
One of the things both of you talk about repeatedly is sort of collaboration, especially in terms of projects that will necessarily be long-term projects, like sustained observation in a specific quadrant or broadcasting. Where do you see that collaboration coming from in the future? Is it, it's traditionally sort of been an intergovernmental affair. Do you see it staying that way, or do you see sort of the private space movement moving into this sort of observation?
Yeah, well, I'm a real huge fan of New Space, but maybe you want to take that.
Well, so am I. And I think that the question, you know, can be broadly applied to both of our topics. There is an enormous amount of international collaboration in the planetary science community right now. You know, there's two NASA orbiters, a European orbiter and an Indian orbiter, or three NASA orbiters, a European and an Indian orbiter around Mars right now. The Europeans are studying the comet with the Rosetta spacecraft. NASA has missions here, and other countries. Russians are studying things over there, and Swedes and Brazilians, and you know, it is an international enterprise, and it's always exciting when new countries come in. For the big projects, like, you know, sending people out there, eventually, I think that the new space community, the companies like SpaceX and others that are trying to come up with dramatic ways to decrease the cost of launching into space could make a big difference. And, you know, NASA and other space agencies are proceeding with their more traditional plans, but it really will be game-changing if these little companies, not so little anymore, could come in and just shake it up dramatically. So, Elon Musk wants to get to Mars. He's got a fortune behind him to try to make that happen, and so far he's doing exciting things, and he's not the only one, so I'm very enthusiastic about that.
And I'd actually say that the collaboration you're asking about is going to come from your generation and from my granddaughter's generation. You have grown up in a world that is far more global than any that we knew in the past, and I think just that social networking, the awareness of the rest of the world is what's going to lead, just not maybe smoothly, not easily, but I think that there are people that are going to say, hey, wait a minute, we're all Earthlings. Let's figure it out.
Okay, we're just going to take the people who are standing at the mic now, okay, no more, and please make it as short as possible.
And Dr. Kepler, Dr. Tarter, you're talking about the Kepler telescope seeing blinks caused by the rotation of planets around distant stars, and you're able to calculate the frequency of rotation by the time between the blinks. Now, if you knew the distance of those planets to the star, you'd be able to calculate its size. Or if you knew its size, you'd be able to calculate the distance from the star to the surface. But you seem to be able to get both those information from that limited information, and I can't figure out how with my limited knowledge of physics.
Well, it's Kepler's laws. In fact, the depth of the transit is determined by the ratio of the stellar diameter to the planetary diameter, right? And the orbital period gives you the distance from the star. And if you can, in fact, then calculate the mass from the radial velocity studies that are made from the surface, you can get the density. But it's you can get wrong here if you have wrongly assumed or calculated the size of the star. If that goes wrong, that's kind of a key component, and everything else you will infer is also going to be wrong.
Thank you.
The back, please.
I think it was Stephen Hawking who actually warned us not to mess with anybody out there because they'll step in, use us, and abuse us, and just wreck the whole place. You know, open a sweatshop or something.
Yeah, well, Stephen Hawking, as brilliant as he is, and me, for whatever I am, neither of us are any experts in extraterrestrial sociology, right? So my take on that is, if they can get here and be a threat of any kind, if they can get here, they are technologically more advanced than we are. I don't see how you can get to be an old technology unless you get over the aggression that would lead us to make those kinds of assumptions.
Yeah, this point is rather moot because we have been broadcasting for decades, intentionally and non-intentionally, so we're out there.
Yeah. We've been leaking.
Yep.
In the front.
Professor Bell, I'd be curious if you have any comments regarding Mars One, which has generated some media attention over the last few months.
Yeah, so Mars One is this group of folks who want to organize a mission to Mars, a one-way trip to Mars that's funded by the sort of entertainment industry as a kind of a reality show. And you know, they're serious about it.
Hey, would you watch it?
Wouldn't you?
They're serious about it. They're raising money. They're serious about the idea. I don't think they're particularly serious or viable about how they're going to do it. They kind of blindly claim they're just going to buy, you know, parts, spacecraft parts and supplies and all that off of the aerospace industry and, without really thinking it through very well. And their schedule is extremely aggressive. That said, many of them are sincere, some of them are not, but many of them are sincere people who want to realize a dream of traveling to another world, and I can appreciate that. And many of them have this romance about their destination. And look, you know, I'm a big fan of Mars. You may have noticed from my presentation. But romantic is not the word you should use, right? If you could somehow survive the trip in a low-bid built spacecraft and not killing each other because the people were picked to be kind of, you know, Lady Gaga types and interesting to the entertainment industry, if you could survive that trip and you get there and then you land, and if you could survive the landing, let's see, you have nothing to do. Nothing to eat once you run out of supplies, nothing to drink once you run out of supplies. Nothing to breathe. In an environment that is dosing you with enormous amounts of ultraviolet, solar and galactic cosmic rays, where the temperature gets down to minus 110 C every single night. I think that would kind of suck.
You could watch reality shows beamed from Earth.
I think that'd be a very short reality show. Look, I want to go. I want to go. I want to come back. Okay? I want to come back. Earth is my favorite planet. I've lived here most of my life, and most of my friends are from here. So, you know, I wish them well, but I think they're dreamers. I think they're dreamers, and I'm not sure they're going to be successful.
Okay, last question.
Dreams may show us places that we otherwise hadn't thought about going.
Sure.
Without them, it's hard to imagine getting anywhere.
I agree.
Just have a very short question that I would like an expert's opinions on. I read last week that Pluto is people are saying that it should be classified as a planet again. I'm just wondering how you guys feel about that.
Never give up. Pluto is a planet. Look, I'm gonna hold forth here for a moment. I'm sorry. So, you know, I'm a card-carrying member of the International Astronomical Union. Okay, I didn't happen to be at the meeting where they voted on this, voted Pluto out of the club.
Circus.
I can imagine I missed a wonderful circus. But to me, okay, to me, I would judge a planet like I would judge a person. It's not what they look like. It's not where they happen to come from. It's who they are. It's what they are at their core, okay? What does it take to be a planet? It takes you have to be big enough, to have enough gravity, to have had an interesting history. Maybe you've differentiated into a core mantle and crust. Maybe you have an atmosphere. Maybe you have moons. You've had some interesting geologic and atmospheric processes going on in your lifetime, and you preserve that record on your surface and your atmosphere and your interior. Okay, so does Pluto fit that? Let's see. It's, you know, the most accessible of this large population of objects in the outer solar system, Kuiper Belt objects. Models indicate it's probably differentiated. It has an extremely complex and strange icy composition. It has an enormous companion moon and four others. It has five moons. It has an atmosphere that comes and goes. It's a frickin' interesting place. I call it a planet, okay? But I call Io and Europa, Ganymede and Callisto planets. Complex histories, Europa with the largest ocean in the solar system, potentially. Titan, a world larger than Mercury. Larger than Mercury, and perhaps more interesting than Mercury. I'm a big fan of Mercury, by the way. By my reckoning, I think there are about 35 planets or so in our solar system, and probably a few hundred more left to be discovered way out there, objects that have had those kinds of interesting histories. And it's like, oh, we have to make our children memorize all those names. Oh, boo-hoo. You know, well, in the U.S., we make them memorize the names of the capitals of all the states, for goodness sake, you know. Let's make them memorize the planets in our own solar system.
Yeah, and my take on that is that Pluto has been doing perfectly well, thank you, no matter what we think.
That's true.
And the question is whether or not we have eight planets or whether we have 800. Whether Pluto is really the tip of the iceberg of a very large population of bodies that we haven't yet discovered, but which could tell us an awful lot about how the solar system actually assembled itself.
The question is going to come up a lot over the next year, because next summer the New Horizons spacecraft will fly past Pluto. They've been flying for 9 years to get there, 1 year to get to Jupiter, fastest rocket we've ever launched. Gets to Jupiter in 1 year. It still takes 8 years to get to Pluto after that. Talk about a big solar system. And they'll fly right past, take great pictures of Pluto. We'll see what it's really like. It's going to go from that dot to a real world along with its moons. And this debate is going to keep going.
And that's 9 years. And it's amazing, eh? Those aliens are coming from hundreds of light years away and evading all of your radio telescopes, and maybe they're not broadcasting when they're approaching the Earth, right? And they're evading everything and landing in front of a pickup truck in North Dakota.
or crashing in Roswell, right? Yeah. They just missed that last mile.
Well, I'd like to thank our speakers again. And tomorrow night, same time, 5:30, please join us. Two other great speakers, Dr. Sarah Sager from MIT, who's been called the Indiana Jones of astronomy, and I'm keen to find out why that is. And Joel Nickel, who is an investigator of all kinds of mysterious phenomena, from ghosts to hauntings of all kinds to unidentified flying objects, myth or reality. So please join us tomorrow, and I thank you for attending tonight.